been hosting you here in Tucson if we had not been socially distancing. So this is our first, and we all hope last, virtual Arizona Space Grant Symposium. The symposium is an annual event. I do want to thank everyone for all your hard work. Of course, the interns who have been working under circumstances that that none of us were expecting. Many of you accomplished some really nice projects. I really appreciate that. I want to thank all the mentors who have been working with the students throughout the year. I want to thank the family and friends, the people who have supported all the people who are going to be presenting today. And I especially want to acknowledge our graduating seniors. If we had been doing the in-person version of this at the banquet last night, we would have read the names of the graduating seniors and made you stand up on stage and given you a sash and that sort of thing. I know that you're all missing a commencement exercise at your home institution as well. I'm very sorry for that, but we are not going to turn everybody's camera on. But what we are going to do is that during the breaks and so on, we'll have a background slideshow, and that slideshow does include lists of the graduating seniors from each of the institutions. And so we do want to recognize you and honor you. A little bit about doing this as a Zoom meeting. We are going to have a host, and the participants will be the only ones that we want to have off mute or on camera. But we do encourage everyone who is here to jump around. There are going to be three parallel, after the keynote session right now, there are going to be three parallel sessions. I'd encourage you to look at the virtual booklet that you got and jump between sessions, see the interesting things that your friends are doing. Look out, when you see a title that you think, I don't know what that is, but that sounds kind of interesting, I'd encourage you to stop in and take a look. That's always one of the glories of having the in-person meeting, is that you go to see a talk by your friend, and then you find out that, oh, the one before that was really interesting too. But of course, we can't do quite the same things of, you know, going and talking to each other. The advantage, though, to Zoom is that we are able to have people here from who are not able to travel to Tucson or Phoenix. I know that our keynote speaker, Marie Baja, who I'll introduce in a moment, is coming to us virtually from Texas. I know that the Space Grant Deputy Project Manager, Erica Alston, I'm not sure if Erica is logged in yet, but she's going to be joining us from Virginia. I suspect that there are a number of our presenters who are presenting from out of state, or may have parents or friends from out of state who are watching. And frankly, that's an advantage doing this as a Zoom meeting. But you still have to do a presentation. And I know that doing a presentation, many of you have not done a public presentation before, and that can be intimidating. Trying to do it through technology in some ways is even more intimidating, because you worry, oh, is my connection going to fail? Oh, is my microphone sound level right? All of those things. So that's part of the added complication. And looking through the booklet, looking at the abstracts, I could see that some of them were projects that you'd really accomplished a lot on. There were others that I could really tell had been interrupted in progress. It's hard, you know, with labs shut down, if you were doing something lab-based, you couldn't do it. Even if you were doing something theory-based, I know that not everyone has really good Wi-Fi connections, that sort of thing. So it is a challenge. But then again, well, maybe we should think of it as an experiment, that the whole thing that we're doing here, whether we wanted to or not, we are doing a huge experiment in education, in psychology, in sociology, in politics. We're doing an experiment in the way we do things. And if you're going into science or engineering, a lot of what you will do involves experiments or trying something new. You have to be willing to try something new, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But that is part of the way that it always works. And in fact, if we were doing this symposium in person, I know that we would have some presentations where it's clear that you accomplished what you intended to for the year, and others where it's like, ah, you were on the way, but just couldn't quite get there. And science in particular is like that. There's always a question left unanswered. Engineering, maybe you designed it right for this application, but there's always another application that's a little bit different. So think of us as experimentalists. And so I welcome you here, and I hope that we all have a, I hope that we keep the technological glitches to a minimum. We will do our best, but please grant us forgiveness if we make mistakes with the technology. Please grant forgiveness to your fellow speakers if they make a mistake with the technology, because we're all new at this in a lot of ways. So without further ado, I want to do two things. First, I won't ask people to come off mute, but I do want to recognize the people who are the Space Grant staff. You'll be from the state of Arizona. You'll be seeing and hearing more of them as we go through. They will be running the sessions. And so from Arizona, we have, I'm not going to be able to see who all is on here, but Chandra Hollifield is here. I believe Yancey Shirley is here. Michelle. From Arizona State, we have Tom Sharp, Alexa Drew, and Desiree Crawl from Northern Arizona, Paloma Davidson and Nadine Barlow. From Embry-Riddle, we have Ron Madler and Elliot Briner. And if I have forgotten somebody, my apologies. These are the folks that you have probably been working with off and on. And so I really do want you to give your appreciation to them at some point. But now, one of the highlights is always hearing from someone interesting, giving us a keynote speech. And this year, Marie Bajah had agreed to do this. Of course, he was going to come in and give a talk last night and then join us for today. But instead, what we're going to do is have Mariba give his talk this morning. And Mariba is a fascinating character. I think this will be a great talk. Mariba is a former Space Grant intern. He got his bachelor's at Embry-Riddle, where, as I say, he was a Space Grant intern. He got a master's and PhD at the University of Colorado doing astrodynamics and orbital determinations. He worked doing a variety of things. He was a spacecraft navigator at JPL, which I think is I think it is as exciting as it sounds. He worked for the Air Force Research Lab, then became the founding director of the University of Arizona's Space Object Behavioral Systems Group, and is now an associate professor in the Department of Aerospace Engineering and Engineering Mechanics at the University of Texas in Austin, and is leading the Advanced Science and Technology Research in Astronautics Group. But I have to tell, besides giving sort of the life history, that just reading a list of places and jobs, I have to tell one story about Mariba, which is the first time I met Mariba, the University of Arizona was thinking about getting into what we call space situational awareness. I think Mariba will be talking more about what that is later, but trying to figure out what's where out there with the man-made things in orbit. And we were talking with Air Force Research Lab. Now, when I say we, that's sort of the general we. I wasn't a big part of it, but I was aware of the discussions going on. There was a meeting between a bunch of people from the Air Force Research Lab and a bunch of people from the University of Arizona that I went to. And there were all these people there, and some of them had really impressive titles. And I realized that everybody in the room was deferring to one person. He did not have the fanciest title. He did not speak the loudest. He did not speak all the time. But it seemed like when people really had a question, well, how's that really going to work? They'd say, well, let's ask Mariba, because Mariba was the one who seemed to have this grasp of the big picture. And I think he always has. And I am absolutely delighted to introduce Marie Bajan.
Thank you so much, Tim. Thanks to everybody at U of A and all over Arizona and everybody who's coming in from who knows where in the world. I'm going to just first and foremost say that I'm going to give you an idea of kind of the trajectory that I've gone through to this point. I'll give some examples from my current research program and hopefully have some time for some questions and answers. And for all the students that are logged on, I want to say that I was exactly where you're at sometime in like 1998 or something like that. So I get it, and I'm excited for you. How about that? So let's go through this whole technology thing that Tim spoke about, and I am hopefully sharing my screen with you. Hopefully everybody can see that. All right, so let's go through here. So humble beginnings, I was born in San Francisco. My father is from Sierra Leone. My mother from Haiti. Both of them got married, had me in San Francisco, but then, as with many marriages, things didn't quite work out. Got divorced when I was quite young. My mother met this guy from Venezuela. I moved to Venezuela, to Caracas, when I was about 6. And so I grew up in Venezuela. So I speak Spanish, certainly English, I hope a little bit, some Haitian and French, some Italian, that sort of thing. But I grew up in Venezuela. And, for high school, I went to a military school, a Venezuelan military school. I was the only American U.S. citizen that had gotten into the school and successfully made it. 250 of us went in, and 41 of us graduated. And I graduated second in my class. And after military school for high school, which was quite different, it was a boarding school, I came back to the United States, and I enlisted in the U.S. Air Force. And my job was to be a security policeman at Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana. I didn't even know where Montana was when I got my assignment. I had to look it up on a map. And interestingly enough, they call Montana Big Sky Country. It certainly is that. And I had never seen skies so dark in my life. My job was to guard nuclear missiles, intercontinental ballistic missiles, as it were, Minuteman II, Minuteman III systems. And when I was looking at the skies at night guarding these nukes, again, I'd never seen skies so dark. I saw dots moving across the sky. They weren't planes. They certainly weren't shooting stars or meteors. They were satellites. They were dead, some dead, some alive objects that humans had put in space. And that sparked a huge curiosity with trying to understand, why were these things up there? Why were they moving the way they moved and that sort of thing? So I got out of the military. I ended up going to Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Prescott, Arizona. It's there where I met Professor Ron Madler, colleague, dear friend. And, initially I was thinking about aircraft design. I was one of the first students that was started this whole space, track there at Embry-Riddle. And, he inspired me. He made it seem like it was possible for me to eventually, who knows, work for NASA one day. He had done all this research in debris, which I thought was extremely unappealing, because I wanted to work, Mars stuff. Mars was the thing. Sojourner was hadn't, I think it was, about to happen, hadn't quite happened yet. And so I was very excited about this prospect of Mars. So the space debris thing really wasn't interesting, but the astrodynamics, the science that studies motion of objects in space, that was certainly extremely interesting to me. So in a moment of weakness, I got accepted in the Arizona Space Grant program, and that's really what helped me do some really awesome research as an undergraduate student. I got to present in a couple of conferences, one part of American Society of Mechanical Engineers, another one, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, and I was able to present these papers, and the research that I did was really what pushed me into graduate school, because I didn't know that I loved research as much as I did, and I wasn't a very great test taker. My GRE scores weren't awesome, but the fact that I did research and I was part of the Arizona Space Grant made me, I guess, seem a bit more appealing to different graduate programs. So following in the footsteps of Professor Madler, who did all his stuff at Colorado, well, so did I. So I decided I'd go to grad school. I got accepted at University of Colorado at Boulder. And so I did my master's in astrodynamics there. I got, following my master's, I got a full-time job offer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, where I was a spacecraft navigator. And so really what that means is it was my job to figure out where was the satellite, where is it going, and basically give that information to people so that they could re-vector the satellite to kind of an ideal trajectory sort of thing. So basically, how do I get stuff to different parts of the solar system successfully? That opened up a lot of doors. I never thought that I'd be able to work with European Space Agency colleagues on things like Mars Express, for instance. So that's a picture of me in the mission control room at the European Space Ops Center in Darmstadt, Germany. Here's me with some JPL colleagues by the engineering model of the Rosetta spacecraft that rendezvoused with a comet not that long ago. Here are the navigators that were working on Mars Express, helping Europe be successful with their first mission to Mars, which was really awesome experience. Somewhere along the way, I got married. Cassandra, who's there, and by the way, we don't dress like this every day. This was Halloween. I just decided to put on a costume as a somebody who had earned their PhD, which I recently did. This just shows my lack of creativity in a sense. But yeah, Cassandra also went to Embry-Riddle and studied under Professor Ron Madler as well. And she also went to grad school at Colorado. So got married, had a couple of kids, moved to Maui. And so I left JPL and decided to work for the Air Force Research Lab. And this is me with Lieutenant Governor Duke Ayona at the time talking about space surveillance and space traffic. Now, not so much things orbiting the Earth, Mars, but things now orbiting the Earth. I got to do some really cool things, like visit the house of Johannes Kepler, who's one of the forefathers of celestial mechanics in Prague. So experiences that I never imagined I'd be able to do. Working with scientists across the globe, here with chief scientists of the Air Force and some folks at University College London. I've chaired some NATO activities related to space surveillance and space tracking. This is me at some NATO facilities in northern Germany. I even got to meet the late Alexei Leonov, who was the first person to ever do a spacewalk successfully. And I met him at the United Nations. He came out of, giving a beautiful presentation. He came out the door. He said, "I really like your hair." And I said, "I'd really love a selfie." And so he accommodated that. And so I was able to meet him, and seemed like a really great person. And then I decided to leave the Air Force Research Lab recently, did some time there at University of Arizona briefly, but now here at UT Austin, where I lead a program in space situational awareness and space traffic. All right, so getting to some meat of stuff here. Satellites, so what? Well, satellites are pretty useful for a lot of things. They provide critical services and capabilities regarding things like position, navigation, timing. Certainly, we're able to locate not just ourselves, but loved ones, things that we care about all over the globe with these systems and empowered by our smartphones and cell phones. We're able to get weather warnings. I mean, we've gone from looking out the window to see what the weather is going to be like. And, the predictive capability of looking out the window to forecast things, probably not as good as being able to see things from, several hundred miles above the Earth's surface. Ability to tell us, hey, you need to get out of the way, think about going someplace else, because in a few days, you're going to have some really rough weather. So that's really awesome. And satellites can see not just in visible range, but in other spectral lines, and can tell us things that just humans with their naked eye just can't tell, which is really awesome. We also have an ability to look at things right below the surface. How much water content is in the soil? Where does it make sense to grow crop? These are things that are all enabled and powered by space-based capabilities. Education. A lot of people take it for granted, but not everybody around the globe has internet, actually. And the power of being able to get information to remote areas is greatly enabled by satellite technology. Even things like, you know, financial market information, banking information, financial transactions are time-stamped based on, you know, space services and capabilities. So what if all this stuff, like, you know, went the way of the dodo? Well, maybe that's not so good if all those things disappeared. We'd be set back quite a ways. So the currently assumed space object population, I say assumed because this plot comes from NASA's Orbital Debris Program Office at Johnson Space Center in Houston, tries to hypothesize what the population is going from like 1 millimeter all the way to the space station. We can't track things as small as 1 millimeter. We can track things maybe as small as a softball or your cell phone. And so, you know, the number of things that we track is roughly about 26,000 objects orbiting the Earth. Out of those 26,000, there's probably about 3,000 objects that actually work, and everything else is garbage. So we have a lot of garbage orbiting the Earth. And this is just gives you an idea of, you know, the growth of the population over time. This is a movie by Analytical Graphics, and just shows you ever since Sputnik in the late 50s all the way to now, how that population has been growing. And, you know, interestingly enough, there's the new bonanza gold rush in space. And, you know, you have different companies that are trying to launch thousands and thousands of satellites in the next 5 years to provide things like global internet and that sort of stuff, like Elon Musk's Starlink constellation and that sort of thing. But this gives you an idea kind of the growth as a function of time of that population. Let's see, let's go here next. And every once in a while, things collide in space. Here's a simulation of an actual event that took place. One of the Iridium satellites unfortunately collided with a dead object from the Russian Cosmos. And this gives you an idea of when things collide in space, what happens? And you can kind of see, oh, wow, you got debris clouds that are generated, many, many thousands of objects, and they kind of move in relative directions that they had kind of prior to the collision. But you can kind of quickly see, and again, this is a simulation, but gives you kind of a graphical idea of just how this trash gets created and how all of a sudden it just starts engulfing the planet, you know, which is bad news. It's a huge problem because we can't track all of those pieces. And, you know, now we have to fly satellites that actually do provide critical services, you know, through that mess. We have to live with that somehow. A project that we've been working on here at UT, Astrograph, initially funded by the FAA, we have this graph database where we collect multiple sources of information about the space object population and provide that for people to see all over the globe. This is an idea of kind of within the next few years, who wants to launch lots and lots and lots of satellites. So you have SpaceX, OneWeb, unfortunately, I guess they just filed for bankruptcy, but there's some satellites of OneWeb up there already. You know, Project Kuiper with Amazon, and not Blue Origin, but Amazon, they want to launch a lot of stuff. And just to give you an idea of the locations, there you can kind of see as a function of altitude, the number of satellites. And if all these things were separate from each other, that would be one thing, but you can see that there's some overlap, which means that there's shared space. And so I want you to think about that near-Earth space is a finite resource. There are specific orbital highways where we put stuff, and I'll show you that here in a little bit. And we have to share that space. It's a common space that we need to share. All right. So if you didn't kind of get an idea of what the problem is, let me put it to you in even crisper terms. Basically, there's no titles or deeds for orbital space. Outer Space Treaty says it's res communis, so it's a common heritage of humankind. But interestingly enough, there are like no kind of global space laws that we can just apply to everybody and even enforce. So that's an issue. There's this new gold rush that I told you about. Everybody's trying to put as much stuff on orbit as possible to capitalize on space commerce that's starting to boom. With cheaper access to space, it means that people can, you know, put more and more stuff up there without having to suffer the huge cost that they did before. And, you know, what are new space actors doing and how are they behaving, and are they behaving sustainably, right? So, okay, so there's no agreed upon space traffic rules, but people are basically given a license to get on the road. So imagine everybody gets a driver's license, okay, but there are no rules of how you should actually drive on the road. Hopefully you can see that that might create some issues. So there's this thing called space situational awareness. Think of that as just knowledge of how to make decisions about stuff in space. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit about that. Basically, you have this space environment. Space environment is very dynamic. The sun's doing stuff. The gravity field is doing things. Charged particles, electromagnetic field. So it's a very dynamic environment. And in that environment, now you place an actual satellite or some space object. And so the question is, what are the effects and impacts of that environment on the object? And we don't fully know that. To some extent, we know some of the disruptions that Mother Nature can cause to operational satellites. We also know to some extent how the environment pushes and torques objects, causing them to move in a variety of ways, but it's not rigorous, it's not completely comprehensive. There's a lot that we still don't know. So that's like the noise floor, as it were. You know, space environment effects and impacts on objects. And then there's these hazards of things colliding, like I told you, right? We definitely want to prevent that from happening as much as we can. But then there's also threats. There's never been a domain of human activity that's been absent malicious behavior. I mean, very recently in the news, just like past couple days, you could actually go Google it. Seems like Russia just tested another anti-satellite capability. The U.S. certainly, has tested these sorts of things before. India just did, about a year ago, blowing up one of their own satellites in low Earth orbit, unfortunately. China did a similar thing. So that's not so good. So that sort of activity of possible, arms conflicts in space, and even malicious behavior, period, even from commercial people with other commercial people, we want to have a way to try to prevent that from happening. So what should things like space situational awareness provide? Look, if we want space to be safe, secure, and sustainable, I argue that it needs to be transparent. We need to know where everything is all the time, if possible. We need to be able to predict how things are going to behave and how people are going to behave operating their satellites given any specific event. And we need to collect the body of evidence to hold people accountable for their behaviors in space. That way we can hopefully make sure that things can be long-term sustainable. Some ingredients for success, certainly an ability to independently monitor space. And so I'll talk a little bit about that later. We need to develop sustainability metrics like a space traffic footprint that I've been thinking about, kind of like a carbon footprint analog for objects in space. Understanding the orbital capacity, what's the capacity of the environment to sustain operations safely? And I'm working with the World Economic Forum with a team from the European Space Agency, MIT, and Bryce Technologies to develop a space sustainability rating that we could pretty much assign to launchers and operators to incentivize them to behave responsibly in space. So we have a few challenges. Again, I talked about space environment effects and impacts. How does this disrupt actual operations and electronics on board some of these satellites? The other thing about space situational awareness, which is a bit unfortunate, is that given some evidence, oftentimes multiple hypotheses that can be very different from each other explain the same evidence. Meaning, if satellite 1, 2, 3 stops working, well, what was the cause of that? Was it because Mother Nature did something that disrupted the electronics? Was it because Jimmy schwacked the satellite when I wasn't looking because Jimmy doesn't like me for X, Y, or Z reason? Was it a micrometeoroid that impacted the satellite in the wrong place at the wrong time? Was it a piece of human-made debris? So there are a number of things that could explain that anomaly. What we'd love to be able to do is we'd like to get to one-to-one causal relationships. That's the goal, is to remove ignorance so that we can arrive at these one-to-one causal relationships. Unfortunately, in our field, just like in many other fields, there's confirmation bias. And I'd call it behavior inertia, belief inertia, in that once we start kind of coalescing on a belief, we tend to dig our heels in and not really pay attention to new evidence. And there's a danger in that because, you know, unless we're all knowing, you know, we can actually be quite wrong. And so part of the research that we're doing is trying to better understand and quantify this level of confirmation bias and open ourselves to the possibilities of other hypotheses being able to explain the evidence that maybe aren't necessarily our strongest beliefs. We don't share information comprehensively about stuff in space, unfortunately, and that could lead people to make flawed decisions. So partial knowledge and making decisions that could be life or death for some people doesn't quite, you know, mix so well. Let me give you an example of things that contribute to, you know, what makes things move in space. So astrodynamics 101, forces acting on a spacecraft. So you got gravity from the Earth as a point mass. You have gravity from the moon, the sun. You have photons from the sun interacting with different surfaces of objects. Things heat up. There's energy gets absorbed, re-radiated, you know, thermally. The planet actually re-radiates energy as well thermally and also reflects photons on satellite surfaces. Things that are communicating, you know, Newton's kind of third law of equal opposite kind of effects, right? You get antenna recoil because of power coming out of antenna. You have tidal effects. The fact that the Earth is kind of lumpy, it's not a complete, you know, total perfect sphere. Other planets and relativistic effects. So one of the things that we need to do is we need to be able to understand the population of stuff up in space as rigorously as possible. We need to identify pieces with a first and last name. We need to perform a census. Just like you perform a census in a city, in a nation, we need to conduct a census of things in space. And we haven't been able to do that rigorously because we can't just go up and tag individual objects because it's very expensive to go up there. So we need to do this tagging remotely somehow. The difference between detecting stuff and tracking stuff is that detecting is just like the word says, you detect some stuff, but tracking implies detecting and identifying. So here's a plot from the Space Surveillance Telescope. It's a single night's worth of data. All the dots are detections, but the black dots are detections that are ascribed an identity, and all the stuff that isn't black are just things that we have no clue what they are. So this is on a nightly basis. So you can imagine this is a problem. You know, we have this background clutter of stuff that we detect, but we have no clue what it is, where it's going, and what it could possibly do. So another way to spin this is we have an identity crisis in space. Given a bunch of observations of things that don't self-report their identity, how do you combine physics, math, and all this cool stuff to ascribe a first and last name to all these individual objects? Part of the research that we're doing at UT is I'm calling it biometrically inspired space object recognition, much like with fingerprinting, where you have an enrollment verification identification phase. What salient features can we collect on these objects that we can use kind of as a biometric signature? Interestingly enough, I talked about how photons can interact with satellite surfaces, and we can kind of observe these things being reflected off of satellites. What we're doing, and this is an example from real data from TOPEX, is we can collect these photons at a very high rate, say at like 50,000 times a second. And at that 50,000 times a second, 50 kilohertz, we can see very interesting features of space objects. And again, this is real data from TOPEX. This is just giving you a graphical interpretation of exactly kind of that different types of scattering of these photons. And
I'm having trouble hearing you.
Yeah, sorry, I don't know what happened there. All right, moving on. So basically what we're doing is this. Once we can, from the photons that get reflected as a function of time, the first thing that we do is we try to understand the orientation of the object with respect to the inertial frame and certainly with respect to the observer. And once we can get what that orientation is over the time that we collected the data, in the body frame of that object, we basically imagine a unit sphere, and we know where all these photons got reflected in the body frame moving away from the object. We can then build a heat map on that unit sphere and basically expand that into a 2D projection, which is a Mulvady projection in our case. And interestingly enough, when we do that, here's what we see. Here's real data collected from TOPEX projected into this Mulvady projection, And you can see from the front of the spacecraft, you can see some kind of aggregated photon reflections from the front, which is front of the solar panels. From the side of the spacecraft, you see glints. The back is more diffuse, which makes sense with the solar panels. It's not as reflective. And so this is, we're trying to build like a face of this object. And here is an example of the face of TOPEX from two nights. Part of this is not populated with data because we didn't actually observe that part of the spacecraft. So we're only showing you the parts that we actually did observe. And so we're trying to basically use facial identification techniques to see if this is a way that we could biometrically kind of fingerprint objects in space. So anyway, so who cares about this stuff? Well, turns out a lot of people care. This was at U of A, University of Arizona, a couple of years ago, where Representative Martha McSally led a panel specifically on this topic with Micah Ensley, former chief scientist of the Air Force, and other people from like DARPA and NASA as well. You know, former associate administrator at the FAA for commercial space transportation, George Neild, Major General Heidi Brown from US Strategic Command at the time. Here's me with NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine, with Martha McSally as well. I got invited a couple of times to testify to Congress. You know, here's me in the Senate with Senator Cruz to talk about this stuff. Here's me in the House with Representative Brian Babin from Texas. And, you know, the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee, I've been invited to give some talks there as well to talk about this sort of stuff. I've even met, you know, President Mata Bio from Sierra Leone, who's interested in, you know, how does space help Sierra Leone with agriculture and disaster relief and all these things. I talked to Al Gore about how space debris isn't climate change, but we do need environmental protection to be extended to near-Earth orbits and that sort of stuff. Again, testifying to Congress, here's me at the United Nations talking about this stuff very recently. People in Australia care about this stuff as well. Gave a TED talk recently on this for the first time, you know, last year. But interestingly enough, even with all these travels and all this stuff I'm doing, is just, it's not enough. It's not enough. And so one of the things that I'm going to do here that I want to share with you is I'm going to share some real stuff going on up there. Here, hopefully, you can kind of see, this is astrograph. This is right now. This is the best estimate of all these dots are human-made objects currently orbiting the Earth.
Somebody, we've still got your PowerPoint showing.
Oh, do you? Okay, hold on. Let me, let me do this again. Let me do this. Thanks for letting me know. How about that?
That's good.
Okay, so here are all these dots in space. Each one of these is a human-made object that was put there. And so you might say, so this is a combined set of opinions from people across the globe. And so you might say, okay, well, who cares? You know, does everybody agree on this stuff? The answer is not everybody agrees. So the outer ring is the geostationary ring, geosynchronous ring, 24-hour orbital period. You can see some structure here, some orbital planes here. And again, this is something that we put together here at UT. So you can see that there's this plane of pink dots right there. All those dots came from a single breakup event. So some rocket body, dead rocket body, exploded in a geotransfer orbit not too long ago. And so all those dots are children from that parent object, which is very unfortunate. So these things are real. They're happening. But if I look at, you know, what do I get just from U.S. Space Command, for instance, that would be the space traffic map that I would get, okay, which looks a bit thinner, right, than before. And if I ask the Russians for their opinions, that's what the Russians believe. And so those things aren't necessarily completely aligned. Who's right? Who's wrong? Who do you trust when it comes to this sort of thing? And so that's one of the things that we need to do, is we need to try to reconcile all these different you know, opinions. The other thing that I want to show you is this kind of streaming service that we put together, where it's showing you, out of about 18,428 objects, what's the predicted miss distance between any pair of those objects in the next 20 minutes? So you can see that's a sliding window from now to 20 minutes from now. And, you know, interestingly enough, so that the dots that are green are things that a pair of objects that are both working. Dots that are yellow are where one thing is working and the other one isn't. And dots that are red are both things are dead. And this is anything coming within, predicted to come within 10 kilometers of each other in the next 20 minutes. So these aren't collisions, but you can see that there's a lot of stuff predicted to come within 10 kilometers of each other just in the next 20 minutes. So it's busy. That's the thing. That's the takeaway. It's busy. You can see some histograms of minimum distances between stuff here up on the upper left. One of the things I want you to pay attention to is the histogram of relative speed. You know, 1 kilometer per second is kind of like the speed of a bullet, but you can see a spike at about 15 kilometers per second. When things collide at 15 kilometers per second, even a speck of paint with an object, bad things happen. So usually if we want two things to be in the same place at the same time, we aren't just happy enough for these things to match their position. We want their velocities to match as well. Because when the velocities don't match, then more stuff is created as a consequence. This gives you just another idea of what the population looks like. These are things that we took from Astrograph, and these are all, you know, about 4,000 objects representative of different things in different orbits. But we're looking at things in this specific orbital angular momentum space, H, which is just the cross product of the position with the velocity of those same objects as a function of their inclination. And the cool thing is that you can kind of see, without doing any clustering, you can see that there are different orbital families. We don't put stuff just anywhere. We put things in very specific places. We can clearly see this in specific orbital angular momentum space. Geo objects are on top here. And then you have some retrograde, some synchronous objects here on the bottom. And it's a dynamic space. How is it dynamic? Well, here's a movie of just 10 days worth of motion. And you can kind of see how that stuff moves just over a span of 10 days. But anyways, I want to give some time for people to do questions and answers. So I'm just going to end it there. And I want to say thank you very much for having me.
Thank you very much, Maria. Fascinating stuff. So the way we are going, and this is what we are going to do all day, the way we are going to do questions is ask you to put your questions in the Zoom chat or put question and then we'll call on you. So I think the first question comes from Tom Sharp. Go ahead, Tom.
So is there any way to clean material from orbit? Is there any way to remove it?
Yeah, so great question. So the answer is it depends. I will say that Surrey Satellite Systems, they've demonstrated some technology on how to potentially remove some of the debris. Believe it or not, a lot of it comes from fishing, like literally harpoons and nets, man. It's kind of crazy, but that's some of the stuff that they've demonstrated. If you Google it, you'll find some YouTube videos of that. And then in 2025, the European Space Agency has a mission called ClearSpace, which will rendezvous with what's called the VESPA payload adapter. And they're going to grab this thing and then bring it back as a demonstration of active debris removal. But, you know, that's slow. I'm talking 2025, so 5 years from now. At the rate at which we're polluting stuff, that doesn't spell things out quite nicely. And I would say the major culprit of the trash in space is that we don't have a high compliance rate of people with orbital debris mitigation guidelines. So we need better compliance. That's the first thing that we need. And then active debris removal should also be pursued in parallel.
Are there other questions? I'm mostly seeing notes of applause and great talk, which it was. Is planetary protection a factor you consider in your research?
So one of the things that we're doing is we're looking at better uncertainty quantification methods. So by and large, especially for planetary protection, people assume that any sort of probability of collision is exactly that, probabilistic, and probabilities tend to assume that the inherent error is all due to random behavior. And so what we're saying is, you know what? Not all error is random. Some error is actually systematic. And so in uncertainty quantification world, Aleatory uncertainty is uncertainty that's irreducible and due to randomness. And epistemic uncertainty is uncertainty that's driven by systematic effects and can be clouded by our own ignorance. It's learnable stuff, presumably. And so we're looking at developing better techniques of how to capture and be able to fuse both types of uncertainty with an application. And one of the applications would be to planetary protection. I can't hear you, Tim.
Let's see, Taylor, did that answer your question? Okay, I think, okay, next up, are evasive actions ever used to avoid collisions?
Yes, and so right now, US Space Command has space situation awareness data sharing agreements where once you sign up to that, one of the services that you can get are called conjunction data messages, where I showed you the streaming set of conjunctions, kind of near misses as they were. You will get some sort of message from US Space Command saying, hey, at this time, on this date, at this location, we predict that something's gonna come within so many kilometers of your object with this probability of collision. Do with that as you will. Some people act on that. And I know that for sure, the SpaceX has these Starlink satellites that have automated maneuver capabilities and they factor in these messages. So the answer is yes.
Okay. Bradford, you had a couple questions. Go ahead.
There's actually only one question.
Okay.
The question says, the question is, do the satellites have anything on board where they can see other objects to avoid collision?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Some satellites do make use of their star tracker capabilities to maybe try to image other things around them. US satellites don't tend to do that because they need to get a waiver from NOAA to do that, and not many have gotten that waiver, if any, for a variety of reasons that go beyond the scope of this talk. But some could do that. I will say that a lot of this is basically propagated to the satellites from ground crews that basically compute all this stuff on the ground and then uplink this information to satellites. And then these things can kind of start making some of their decisions on their own. And like I said, the Starlink satellites are examples of automated collision avoidance maneuvers given this sort of capability.
Okay. Ruby?
Hi. Thank you for speaking, first of all. And I was just wondering, I've heard some like projections about how the addition of like new satellites from companies, especially SpaceX, will in the future affect like astronomy observations and like light pollution in the sky. And I was just wondering, I just wanted some more information on that, I guess, and what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, so here's the thing, right? When I looked at the skies back in 1988 to 92, they look very different than they do now. Now you see a lot more dots up there. Now the Starlinks, they're gonna be in low Earth orbit. The only times that you'd really see this stuff is twilight conditions, right? So they'd be eclipsed for most of the night sort of stuff. So certainly it's not zero impact, there's some impact. But I'll say that I've been working with people from Las Cumbres Observatory to try to create some predictive models that could serve the astronomy community so that they could say, hey, here's where I'm at. What's the predicted space traffic over the next, N hours? And what's the predicted brightness, visual magnitude of these things? And so we're trying to work on an application that could allow people to get that sort of information. But yes, the problem's it's not going to get better. Let me put it that way.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Maitri, Bose? Maitri, you don't have your mic on, or do you want me to read it?
Oh, sorry about that. So my question, excellent talk, by the way. I loved your talk. The question I'm thinking about is, what kind of universal laws do we need in order for, you know, agencies like SpaceX like Starlink to put up these satellites and sort of pollute our space, you know? What are the kind of laws we need, and then what are the best ways to enforce it? Can you speak to that?
Yeah, so interestingly enough, I'm going to do something really quick here, and I'm just going to do a screen share, and I'm going to, let's see if I can, I'm just going to chance this really quick. Here we go. So one of the things that we need to do, again, one of the major issues is lack of compliance. So we've put together this website that basically leverages our knowledge graph database. And the only use case that we're looking at here right now is who is compliant and who is non-compliant with properly disposing of their satellites at the end of their life in the geo region. So it's just geo disposal compliance. Here's what I think, right? I think that people just don't, they're not aware. And you can't enforce, you can't manage a traffic system that you don't know of what's going on, and you can't know what you don't measure. So it's all based on measurements. So I'm very much trying to collaborate with people around the globe to collect this body of evidence of behaviors of stuff in space, make that very public, and then, you know, interpret that behavior against known guidelines and policies and be able to show very publicly who's compliant and who isn't compliant. And I'm not going to judge good or bad, but then I'm just going to make it very evident who are the culprits. And I'll let, governments and regulatory agencies then get empowered to figure out how to actually enforce this stuff. But you can't enforce stuff that you don't know, and you don't know things that you don't measure.
Any other questions? Then I'd like to thank you again. The one Zoom thing that I've seen done is everybody unmutes and claps. But I think if we try to do that all day, we're going to get in lots of trouble. But that was a great talk. I really appreciate you doing that. And hopefully, you know, the next time we can get you in person. So we will have a break of a few minutes. And we are going to start our sessions. Michelle, did you have any announcements before we do that?
Just that everybody should feel free to go into their own session, make sure you know where it is, how it's working, before you break out into different sessions. There's 4 sessions total, and the first one will start at 9:40. So we have a couple of minutes to get ready for that. Make sure you're in your session before 9:40, please.
All right, so we will see everyone in various different sessions. And once again, thank you very much to Mariba.
Thank you so much. Cheers. And happy 30th anniversary of NASA Space Grant, right?
Yeah, all right. Thank you.
Thank you.